Hey, this is Kevin from Kevin's Barbecue Joints, and welcome to episode 110 of the Kevin's Barbecue Joints podcast. And we are super excited to have this episode sponsored by The Smoke Sheet, which is a weekly newsletter that I have been a subscriber since day one. It was started by Ryan Cooper, who is the barbecue tourist, and Sean Ludwig, who is NYC barbecue. So great. Barbecue news, openings, closures of barbecue joints, links to really cool podcasts, book recommendations, a recipe a week. Super easy to sign up, just your name and your email, and weekly you will get an email that is chock full of information. Every time I get it, there's something new I didn't know about. And as I've mentioned, I love the fact that they have barbecue events in it because I'm always the last to know about barbecue events. So this way you can stay on top of them, plan ahead, make sure you get to go to them. There's so many cool barbecue events every year. So sign up. It's barbecuenewsletter.com. It's barbecuenewsletter.com. Barbecue news worth consuming. Check it out. You're going to love it. And in this episode, I get a chance to talk to Hugh Magnum from Mighty Quinn's Barbecue in New York. But they have multiple locations now, upwards of 9 locations. This is a really great story. I don't want to get too into it because we get really in depth and it's over an hour, but you're going to enjoy every moment of it. Like many of these stories, he didn't start out in barbecue. He actually started out in music, and that's an interesting portion of his life. And then how he got into the culinary world, and then how he got into barbecue, that those little steps are super interesting. It's also so crazy because he gets so deep into the emotional component of this journey. And at one point, he only had $600 to his name, and he had a wife and kids, and the pressure of that, and what that pressure was, and what he learned from that pressure, and what he appreciates now that he is at this point where they're growing so rapidly. And we talk about the early days of Mighty Quinn's Barbecue, and you're gonna really, really love it. I can't thank you enough for sharing the time, and if you're digging these, please subscribe, that way you don't miss out. I have a website at kevinsbbqjoints.com, but enjoy this. Good morning, good afternoon, how you doing?
I'm good, man. You?
I'm doing well. I'm glad I finally got a chance to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm glad that we could chat.
All right, where are you right now?
I'm in my commissary in Passaic, New Jersey. We have 4 big smokers here. We smoke and deliver to the restaurants that don't have smokers in them.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, cool. Well, I wanted to talk about your history a little bit, and then about Mighty Quinn's, how it started and what it's all about, and then because there's a lot of cool stuff coming up too. So I'll try to make it brief. People don't have great attention spans these days, but did you grow up on the East Coast and then you came to LA? Is that how?
No, it was actually the opposite. Okay. I grew up in Los Angeles. I was actually born in Hollywood at the old Cedar Sinai, which used to be on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
Before they moved it to cross from the Beverly Center, where it is now, by La Cienega. Okay. So I was born in Los Angeles and I lived there through 1999.
Okay.
I lived in Boston for a year. I went to Berklee College of Music, and I spent a lot of time touring as a musician. But I mainly was, LA-based. Okay. Until 99, I picked up and moved to New York to go to culinary school.
Okay, and what was the band?
A few different bands. I played in many. One in particular was Maypole. We were signed to Sony's Work Group.
Okay.
We toured on and off for, my God, a few years, but we did 2 years as the opening act for the Wallflowers.
Oh, wow.
On their Bringing Down the Horse tour, which was like their biggest record.
Okay.
Other notable bands, there was one called Enemy, which was a band that I was in with Troy Van Leeuwen and a guy named Eddie Nappy. But Troy is currently the guitarist for Queens of the Stone Age.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah. I got to live the dream somewhat, I didn't get to have the rock star complete lifestyle, but I got to have some fun,
So did you tour overseas too, or was it just United States?
No, it was all U.S.
U.S. stuff.
All U.S.
That's a cool, so that's like a cool little part of your life it's different than what you're doing, but it's still like, you have a notable life now, but it's different.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was, I'd say the cool part is I got to live the childhood dream of, being in a rock band and going on tour. It just, if the levels are here, like this is like the big time, it was like I was right over here. I was like on the threshold, but never got really past it.
But if you made it to that level, you probably wouldn't be talking to me right now.
No, I wouldn't, but I also probably wouldn't be sitting in Passaic, New Jersey. I'd probably be sitting by somewhere, you know?
That's true. And when you come to LA, do you ever hook up with those guys again and play? Do you ever?
So we haven't played in a while. I mean, I still have my drum sets and play, and my sons, I've got three kids, Quinn, Lucas, and Henry. And Lucas and Henry are big into music, but Lucas in particular has taken a liking to the drums. He plays guitar and drums, and
Oh, rad.
he's already at age 14. He's a crusher and destroys my level of talent and thought, you
That's
know,
awesome.
infinity. But no, when I come out to LA, I mean, mainly when I'm in Los Angeles, I only spend about a week there a month at this point because I'm in New York most of the time, and my wife and kids are currently in LA. But that is kind of a temporary move. But when I'm out there, I've seen like Hans, who's the singer-songwriter of Maypole. He had a birthday party like about a month and a half ago, and we actually, for the first time in like 20 years, the entire group was together.
Oh, that's
At the,
really.
it was great. So it was really great seeing everybody, and you know, we're all still really good friends, and like that's a part of our lives that we remember very fondly. And
You'll
you know,
always have that connection. That'll be really cool.
yeah, and it was the best of times, you know.
So then, how did this, was there some, how did the transition happen? So you went to culinary school. Was that something too that happened to deal with your father? Was your father really into food?
Yeah, so you know, my father. The two things that my father and I shared kind of most as like a passion points when I was a kid were food and baseball. I'm no longer a huge baseball fan, not because I hate it, but just because like American sports to me have just kind of become pretty boring and money oriented. And you know, teams used to be like you could follow. Like I was an Ozzie Smith fan, and I could follow the Cardinals for 10 years,
Exactly.
like the same crew. And now it's like every year you can't keep track of who's on what team, and it's all about the money and. But anyway, I digress. But
That's a real legitimate digression because, like with Steve Garvey, I was a Steve Garvey fan because I lived in LA. And then when he went to the Padres, I was like, what the? Like, that was a big deal. Like, but nowadays, people every 3 years change.
Ozzie actually came from the Padres to the Cardinals, and the Cardinals were like my team. So I used to go to every Cardinals home stand. I would go to every Cardinals home stand when they were at Dodger Stadium. So my dad and I would go. But food was just something we shared. My father worked for the government, and he had a very well-traveled life. He lived in Japan for a while. He basically spent so much time in different places. Japan, Japanese food. I was eating sushi when I was, you know, 6 years old. And we would do barbecue road trips because that was part of his heritage, being from Houston. And there was one place in Los Angeles. Hold on, we're about to serve a staff meal right where I'm sitting, so I'm gonna move.
Okay, no worries.
This is like the real thing. This is really happening.
That's no, I love this. Actually, this is like a big thing that I like.
I'll actually take you to kind of where it all started, which is kind of funny. So I'm walking in my commissary, which is 13,000 square feet, but we have literally like, as I'm going this way, you'll see this is all of our wood
Oh, cool. Lovely.
indoors because of the winter. But where I'm about to sit is actually this is my smoker that I used to take to Smorgasburg. So that's pretty cool. So I'll throw us on some wood, and the smoker will be in the background.
Nice. It's like it was meant to be.
I'm putting you on the smoker. There you go.
That makes sense. Okay, cool.
So, my father road tripped a ton, or you know, he lived in various places. So food was kind of our focus, and then we started, you know, doing like when I was a little kid, we do, you know, barbecue stuff in Los Angeles. And there was one place in LA in particular that was actually kind of like the place that I thought was the best, which was called, still there, I believe, called Dr. Hoagly Wogly's Tyler, Texas,
It's still there. It's still there, yeah.
in Van Nuys, I believe on Roscoe, right?
It's like
My peak
Roscoe
impressor is
and
going off.
Lancashire or something.
Yeah, and it, I mean, it's it, it, I don't I haven't been in, I mean, it's got to be 30 years at this point, or 25 years. But that was the place. Sorry, the compressor for the heat was going off right where I was standing. So it's like I'm a walking barrage of crap. That kind of started the barbecue thing, and then we had a pit in the backyard, so my dad would do barbecue. And then fast forward to when I was a touring musician, my father had moved back to Houston at that point from Los Angeles because he really didn't really love LA. He was there because I was there, and he was married there. And so whenever I would go to Texas on tour, we would stop and I would get to hang with my dad, and we'd go to Dozier's, which is where he went as a kid, and we'd go to, you know, Good Company, and basically just make the rounds, all the places near Houston.
Yeah.
And Hinz's and all these great places. And it was just something that was always in my vernacular and kind of part of my core,
yeah, you know, DNA,
but I just
yeah.
didn't really, I didn't know that it was something I was going to do. I just knew that I loved food and, you know, music was what I was doing. And then fast forward to 1998, my father passed away very unexpectedly.
So
and
sorry.
When he passed away. Oh, no, no, I mean, like, it's what sent me, you know, it's like everyone has their journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's like everyone has their moment, and it's like, you know, you go from being a kid to an adult, and that was kind of like a turning point for me. So when he passed away, he left me a little bit of money, and what I chose to do to honor that was my relationship with him was so based around food and passion for it, because he was such a passionate guy. And well-spoken and well-traveled, that I decided to pick up from Los Angeles. Well, actually, I didn't decide to pick up from Los Angeles. I decided to go to culinary school with the money he left.
Okay.
I originally tried to go to school in Los Angeles, in South Pasadena.
Yeah,
I think it's La Cordon Bleu.
Mm-hmm.
And when I this is, I mean, the timing of this was 1999. I was applying, and that was when, you know, like, Food Network was hitting its apex,
yeah,
in
exactly.
that first kind of stage of like Emeril kicking it up a notch, and, you know, Bobby Flay, who I'm lucky enough now to call like a good friend, and you know, he and Michael Simon, Michael's my mentor, but it, that was the time where it was like, you know, he was doing that show Chillin' and Chillin' and all that
stuff. Was that the with that Cajun guy or
yeah, Jack, what's his name?
Yeah, I forget, he used to wear overalls, right, or something, or
Yes. And he was actually like from Philadelphia, which is the funny part.
I didn't know that.
Wait, like everybody was like thinking, oh, I want to be the next Food Network star. There was that show, you know, everyone was going to culinary school. So Le Cordon Bleu was filled up for like an 18-month wait. And at the time I was still touring with Enemy at the time. And we were going to go on kind of a break because Troy was also playing guitar in a band called A Perfect Circle, which had just like... their debut record came out, so he was leaving to go out to Japan
with
them.
Maynard, wow.
So I had kind of a window of time where I had to go to school if I wanted to do it. So I started looking at schools, and FCI in New York was on my radar, and it was 6 months. It was an immersion program. It had like the kind of the cachet of having Jacques Pepin, you know, as like one of the deans and one of like the, you know, so that's kind of cool. And so I literally got on a flight to New York to go find an apartment because I had a 100-pound Rottweiler, so I needed to find a place that would take dogs.
Okay.
I did like a 2-day tour of New York, found an apartment, flew back to LA, and then within 4 weeks had packed up my apartment in Los Angeles. I was living in Miracle Mile, packed it all up with my dog, and drove across the country to, you know, go move into an apartment in the East Village on 5th Street and 2nd Avenue.
That's crazy. So then, so with when you got the money, you went to culinary school, but then also too, were you thinking while you were at culinary school, I need to come up with an idea for a restaurant, or were you thinking I'm going to work at a restaurant in New York somewhere?
Wasn't even on my radar whatsoever. I had no intention of going to culinary school to do any culinary work. I had the thought of, I do music, and if this thing doesn't work out at some point, like the hours are kind of similar and it's something I love, so I might as well learn how to do it well. And I also thought, like, I mean, truthfully, I was like, well, if I learn how to cook really, really well, then, you know, I'm going to be a good catch for a woman someday.
Exactly. No, I went to culinary school in LA, like, just for that reason. So I know how to cook well.
But there you go. And so the irony of that story was when I called to get into school to apply to FCI, I wanted to go for the September semester and it was full. So I was waitlisted, and I got a call 2 or 3 days after being waitlisted that one spot had opened up. And fast forward almost a year, I was like 6 weeks into school, and I met this girl, Laura, who I saw her coming down the steps, and I was like, holy crap, my knees buckled. Like, I had like a light bulb moment. She's my wife now.
Oh, that's great.
She was actually traveling in Italy and in France, and she decided she wanted to stay in Europe longer, so she postponed her semester semester.
So
she was the spot that opened up for me, was her.
Oh, that's so weird.
She actually,
oh, that is bizarre.
Isn't it crazy?
That's awesome.
Yeah, we found that out like a year after we were together. So,
oh, that's
crazy.
Even better. That's even better.
Yeah, it was cool. So then I went to culinary school, and I fell into it. I was excelling. It kind of clicked. So I did well. I graduated, you know, like top of class, and ended up doing a trail over at John George in Nougatine.
Oh, wow.
And Greg Brandon, on my first day, offered me a job, and I actually turned it down I turned the full-time job down because I was still doing music. Okay. And the beauty of it was that Greg, who's still a friend, he's a drummer. He's actually a huge Tool fan, but he's a drummer, and he totally got like what I was doing. So I got to work. The deal we made was I will work when I'm in New York, but I wasn't getting paid. I was basically working for free, but it was like full time while I was in New York. But then I could pick up and leave if I needed to go to LA to do music stuff.
Awesome.
I was still traveling to LA on weekends and, but then working at JAG at Nougatine when I was in New York.
That's great. That's great experience too. Wow. You must have learned a lot.
And then it culminated in a negative way, with 9/11 happened. And once that happened, everything kind of went haywire for all the restaurants, and obviously for New York and for the world. But that was kind of a turning point where, you know, I was there for a couple more months, and then decided that my wife and I decided we were going to buy a house like out in the sticks in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which we actually bought my father-in-law's place there. And that's kind of what started me on the barbecue path, because I was doing it as a side hustle and for fun. While we had that house, I got my first like barrel smoker.
Okay.
And I was doing like, I was smoking meat like whenever I had time off. It was like, that was what I was doing with my weekends.
You know? So then how did Smorgasbord?
Smorg happened. I mean, we're talking, you know, the amount of time between that and Smorg is almost 7.5 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That would be about 7 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was smoking as a hobby. And then I took over with a venture capitalist from New York. I took over a general store in the middle of this like little village called Carversville in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I was doing gourmet to go. And then one day a week I would smoke meat on this barrel smoker and sell it. You know, just do my own barbecue. And it got to the point where people would call in advance and pre-order, and we would sell out before we opened on pre-orders. So then myself and my best friend, his name is John Criswell, decided to invest in a 16-foot-long trailer smoker so I could do catering and I could increase the volume. And, you know, Quinn, my firstborn son, came into the world in 2003. Okay. And so that was when the name happened, within about a year of that. It was like this genesis of like, one day we're just like, oh, Mighty Quinn's. And it was like, whoa, it just sounded good. And it was like, it wasn't too like barbecue-ish.
No.
You know, it was kind of like, it didn't convey barbecue, which I kind of liked, because we've never been like the cartoon pig company.
exactly.
Which is nothing wrong with that. It's just like, it was just not my vibe, you know? So I started doing catering, and then we bottled the sauce, and Whole Foods picked us up in the Mid-Atlantic region.
Wow, that's a big deal.
It was great. We crushed it. We sold out like, you know, in a few weeks. And then we had one investor, and who will remain nameless. John and I had an investor. And right before we went to go to production to go like nationally with Whole Foods, so we had gotten picked up, he got served with like divorce papers or, you know, something crazy where like he had to pull out. So we had no money.
Like his world crashed.
That kind of put an end to it. That was the genesis of the first incarnation of the business.
Okay.
Then what happened was it just went from being a business to not being a business, and I was struggling to make ends meet. I was kind of, you know, taking jobs cooking wherever I could. I had, at this point, you know, we were about to have, my God, a couple years later, we're on our, on Henry, we have Lucas, and then Henry was coming into the world in 2006. Then we bought a house before we sold the house, and literally timed the market as poorly as you can.
Yeah, that was right.
Yeah, we bought top of market, and then the market went. So we got our asses handed to us. Sat on two houses for 6 years. Lost one house. You know, literally went full on bankrupt. Lost everything. Every penny I had in savings was gone. And it's weird. I look back at it and think about how dark a place I was in when that was all going down. But I also realized that it was so necessary. I'd always been really lucky. I'd always I'd walk in for a gig, whether it was drums or, you know, whatever. And I would get it, you know, and like, this was the first time, like, I had gotten not just like kneecapped, but like kneecapped in my face, rubbed in shit.
You know? Hit in the back of the head with a bat.
Yeah. I got completely clobbered.
But no, this is actually really good for people. I hate to interrupt you, but for people too, because they can get a chance to see, you know, some of them might be in a pretty dark place watching this or listening to this and realize that you can get out, because there's a lot of people that struggle, like most people.
Oh, no. And to your point, man, I mean, it was a dark place. And I also, it's funny because like, there's a couple takeaways. Like, there was parts of that. I mean, it was, you know, the dark place lasted a couple of years, you know, of trying to dig ourselves out, but also flailing a bit. And I can honestly say, like, there's times that I look back, I'm like, man, I'm not proud of, like, my reaction to certain things, mm-hmm. you know, like, but at the same time, I had to kind of go through that to get to a place where I could hit the time where I pulled my bootstraps up and started this thing, you know?
Because you feel kind of cornered at that point too. Like, you feel like everything's coming in up.
Yeah, you feel, you know, you feel cornered, but it's also like,
like the weight of life is on you too. It's like a weird.
Yeah, I would like to say that, like, oh yeah, I reacted great and I handled it, and you know, it was like lickety split, but it wasn't. You know, I had some times where I was just like, I was useless, and you know, I hate to use the term, but like, you feel kind of castrated. Mm-hmm. You know, like I had a wife and three kids who I couldn't provide for, and that, like, you know, that's like, yeah. So like that wasn't just like hard. That was like gut wrenching, but also like debilitating. Mm-hmm. And there was a time where I totally just shut down in the midst of that. Oh. And, which sucks. But again, it's like, you know, you don't know till you know. Mm-hmm. And, so I went through that, and, my mother-in-law, Kathy, and her husband Andy took us. They have like a timeshare style vacation thing where they can go to all these places. And they were doing Disney World, and they invited like my kids and the cousins and my in-laws. We all went down. And I remember, like, it's so weird. It's like certain things that are so vivid. But mm-hmm. we were waiting in line for the Finding Nemo like play at Disney World, and my phone rang. And it was, his name is Adam. And Adam Johnson. Adam is my wife Laura's cousin. And Adam is like this awesome, like, full of life guy who always, he's like the guy who always has an idea. But not always like there are ideas that are not always fleshed out. But right now he's currently he has an amazing business now. And actually, so the business he had started is a business called Withers and Grain. And they do like amazing furniture. They handcraft wood and repurpose wood. But he called me, said, oh, there's a flea market we're selling at, where we launched Withers and Grain, called the Brooklyn Flea. And, you know, I think if you came here with your smoker and sold, you know, pulled pork, you would crush it. You'd make, you know, a couple grand every weekend. And it was like, I hung up, I was like, cool. I said, I'm in line for Finding Nemo, but I'm like, this sounds awesome. And I'll call you as soon as I get back. You know, back up to Jersey. And, you know, like a week later, Adam and I spoke, and I got the information of, the names were Jonathan Butler and Eric Demby, and they had Brooklyn Flea, and, was able to set up a meeting, a face-to-face, where I would come in and do a tasting for them. So, I mean, we're talking, this is 2010. So I drove like food hot off the smoker in a little Cambro hot box, drove to Brooklyn, to their office in Dumbo. And, you know, came in with the hot food and did a tasting, and they were like, we love everything. They said, the one dilemma is we have a guy doing barbecue at the Flea. But in a couple of months, in April, we're launching a new concept called Smorgasburg, which will be food only. Would you be interested? And before they could even say, would you, I was like, I was over the table, like, I'm in, I got this.
Yeah, lock
I'm
it all in, over yeah. it.
Yeah. So, and to their credit, they're super loyal, which is why they didn't want to allow me into I appreciate that, you know? So anyway, April rolled around, and I was trying to get permitting for Smorg, and it was proving a little harder to get, you know, temporary permits. So I had my buddy Fred Strackhouse, who had a restaurant close by my house in Jersey. He was cool enough to lie, or let me use his address to say that I was using his kitchen as a commissary, when in fact I was in my driveway, my gravel driveway, with coolers. And, you know, I had tables set up, and I was literally smoking in my driveway. So I got my permits, and I remember like it was the weekend it was the weekend previous to 4th of July that year, 2010, I guess it was. And 2010. And I was like, I had five briskets on the smoker, four pork butts, and I think like 12 racks of ribs that I was going to smoke on site. And I was in a total panic, like, oh my God, like to my wife, to Laura, I was like, what if they don't like this? And she just plain as day me and said, you know, if we don't sell any food, then we'll just bring it home and we'll invite everybody over and we'll basically have a going out of business sale, you know, on life, and we'll be getting out of the house and we'll go move in with my in-law, you know, with the in-laws. So that was kind of like equal parts scary as shit, but also like she kind of allowed me the space to like, you know, she basically was like, I'm going to be here no matter what, and we're going to be a family no matter what. So like, just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that gave you the ability to succeed.
It gave me the ability to be free enough to go for it. And so she came with me, and Alex Stanko, who is currently like been our executive chef forever, who's still with the company, they came with me. It was the three of us, and we sold out in like 90 minutes.
Wow.
And it was like this amazing explosion of energy, just like feeling so good doing something that like we didn't just believe in, but like it just felt good. You know, it was like we were doing something we loved. We had fun. We were all together. My wife had hand drawn the sign, you know, like a chalkboard. And, but we didn't know, but the Wall Street Journal was there doing photographs for an article they were going to run online regarding Smorgasburg, this new food flea market. And by the way, the market started a couple months prior, but I was taking time to get permitting. So I was coming in like, you know, 6 weeks after everyone else.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So like the next, I think it was like Monday, someone reached out to me and said, oh, your picture's on this article from the Wall Street Journal online. And I was, the cover photo was me and Alex like reaching over at food. So like overnight that happened. And then an email went out to all the vendors, like 100 vendors that were there, saying that Unique Eats, a show on Cooking Channel, was going to be doing a Smorgasburg episode.
Oh, wow.
And they were going to be reaching out to three vendors. So if anyone, you know, gets an email from such and such, you know, from Irene Wong Productions.
That
it's real, you know. And literally not 10 minutes later, I got the email. And I was like, holy shit, I've been there for one, like, it was my first time out. And all of a sudden, like, I'm one of the three vendors.
I think I saw that episode. It aired, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was like, there was like a perfect storm with that, because it aired and there was three vendors. And then the next year, it aired while Smorgasburg was like dwindling down in the spring. Or I'm sorry, not in the spring, in the fall, before like, there was no winter smorg that first year. So then when spring picked up, though, I was the only vendor of the three that returned. One of them like lost, you know, just decided to not do it anymore. And one was like, had gone on to do something else in a different place. Like, I think moved somewhere else. And so it was just me. And so all of a sudden everyone was coming to the market looking for like the vendors that were on that show. And I was the only one. So there was like, there was that perfect storm. And then there was just this thing where I think like we were just fucking hungry, man. Like we were just hungry to like succeed, but we were also just having so much fun that it was so genuine. Like we were, I don't know if you've ever read Eckhart Tolle, but like he's, you know, he's like, he writes books on like, you know, it's like the power of now and being present. And there's something really true to be said about like when you're connected to the moment and everything. Like when we were there and we were doing this and the, like there was the essentials happening, nothing else mattered. Like it was just like when I was like connecting with you as the customer slicing meat in that line, like every customer, like I was looking at in the eyes and having fun with and an interaction with. And there was like, it was a real organic thing that was happening.
And life feels right at that moment too. Like things feel.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, and then there's Malcolm Gladwell's whole concept of like the tipping point, you know, like I had done, unbeknownst to me, I had done 10,000 hours of work on that smoker with all the other stuff I had done. So when I showed up at Smorg, and a lot of vendors, like, you know, would, let's say, maybe be sitting down waiting for people to approach them, like, we were just engaging everybody. We, like, you know, the smoker was there, we had music playing, like, we were, like, you know, just geeking out and having fun. And it was like,
it's infectious. And it's,
yeah, you know, I think, like, I recently heard a talk with the writer Elizabeth Gilbert. I don't know if you know the name, but she wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which is her most famous book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talk about, like, there's this whole talk about, she's written, like, you know, 10 books or 9 books, but everyone, and Eat, Pray, Love was her fourth book, but everyone that recognizes her will be like, oh, I loved your first book.
Interesting.
And, like, it, even though it wasn't her first book, because it was her hit, you mm-hmm. know? And the comment she made that, like, resonated so much was, like, she said, it's like, it, you know, there's no need to correct anybody, because it's so easy to not be a dick. Like, just be appreciative.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And, like, I was so grateful for the moment that I was having, that I was so present and connected. But, like, I was having the moment as much as the customers mm-hmm. were having the moment. So, like, it wasn't just this phenomenon for the customers, or for, you know, for, you know, my kids, or for me. It was like, it was an all-inclusive moment that we were all a part of. Like, wow. We were all a part of this thing, you know? And I still feel like that's the genesis and kind of the love of, like, when I think about, like, cooking barbecue, it's more a matter of, like, this awesome opportunity that came up through, like, this love, this shared love that we all were a part of.
Yeah. And that's a kind of a beautiful thing, and it's something that you'll always treasure as to why this actually happened. And a lot of people people just start restaurants to start restaurants. It's not.
I mean, we were, you know, we ended up being kind of the golden child of Smorg, because we were the first vendor that showed up without a brick and mortar to go brick and mortar, mm-hmm. and, you know, obviously the New York Times looked on us favorably, and that review that Pete Wells wrote was, I mean, talk about a fucking game changer, man. Like, that was that was a moment. Like, I referenced, there was an interview I heard with Steve Carell, and he was saying how, like, the greatest moment for an actor or an actress is getting the call that you got the part. And the scariest moment for an actor or an actress is the moment you hang up the phone and you're like, oh shit, now I have to do this. Exactly. And that was the New York Times for me. It was like, you know, in culinary school, you know, the Wednesday dining in section, dining section of New York Times is like, it's the Bible.
Yeah. Even and here on the West Coast, it is. Yeah.
It's the paper record, you know, it's globally it is. And when that review came out, it was like winning the Academy Award, man. Like, nothing, like, no matter how bad things could ever get at this point, like, if I have a bad day, like, or like a bad year or whatever, like, that moment, like, that will never be taken away. Like, I value that. Like, that's placed so deep in my heart that, like, that will never leave me, you know? So.
Did you get investors at that time? Did people come to you?
So I jumped way ahead. But so I was at Smorg. Things were going amazing. We were obviously, like, it was just the groundswell was building, lines were building. And then, you know, at one point my mother was out in New York from Los Angeles with her husband, my stepfather, Stan. And I was talking to them about, like, what I had been doing at Smorgasburg, and kind of the conversation steered towards, like, I started to have, you know, to work with this idea after going to Chipotle on the way back home every time. So then Stan's son, Misha, Stan reached out to Misha, and Misha was living in New York. So Misha and I hadn't ever really hung together, and it wasn't for a lack of, like, it was just a timing thing. But when he was going into high school, I was already off on the road when, like, our parents got together. So it was just like, it was one of those things where we only crossed paths a few times, but obviously we were friendly enough, and we got together and discussed it, you know, discussed, like, the idea, like, that, you know, that of what to do with this thing, that this phenomenon that was happening. And he then, you know, was, I guess, crunching some numbers. Then he brought his brother-in-law, Christos, who is a second-generation restaurateur, Christos Gormos. He was a partner in the Venetian, one of the owners of the Venetian, which is, like, the largest catering hall in New Jersey.
Okay.
And he brought him to see me at Smorgasburg. And, like, one of the stories that I always tell, but it's, like, it's the way Chris told it to me, was that he showed up at that market saying to Misha, I will never do a restaurant ever again, because he was doing the catering and it was going great. And
wow.
he watched me work for like 20 or 30 minutes and just kind of watched the whole thing and tasted the food. And then he looked over at Misha and said, I don't know about you, but I want to back this guy. So like he changed, he did a 180, you know, and like that was it. You know, it was so funny because like the next week we were like starting to look at places, like looking at spaces, you know, available spaces. And I remember like I had a few people offer to invest in me to open a restaurant. And I just never really took any bait on that. Not because I didn't want to, but it just like, I was just too busy in the moment to think about it at that moment. So when this was happening, it just seemed right. Mm-hmm. And then I remember like the three of us were at dinner and I was like, so wait, like, are we partners? Like, is this happening? And they were like, yeah, you dumbass. You know, like it was so funny because like, it sounds like
a reaction I'd have too.
Yeah. It just happened so naturally and so organically, like everything else had happened that it just, the partnership was formed without having to, you know, without it ever having to be made official until like, I was like, wait, what the fuck? Is this really happening? You know?
Forgive me if I'm trying to figure out with the Chipotle thing, how does that tie in to what you were doing? Is it just because of the way that the streamlineness?
It was like a light bulb moment because when I would leave Smorgasburg, I was exhausted and I had that big trailer on the back of the truck. So I couldn't park in the city, like stop and get food in the city. So I would stop in Bridgewater, New Jersey. There's a Chipotle in the mall in the Bridgewater Commons. And it was the only place that I could pull into. I could take a double spot. It didn't matter. I could park the trailer there. And I would stop there because that's about 30 minutes from where my house was. And I would grab food for everybody who had worked for the day, but also for my kids. Because at that point, like, I was making, like, cash. It was, like, Goodfellas cash. Like, literally, like, stacks of cash, you know, which was freaking awesome, you know. Like, we were down to our last $600 before this thing started, you know. While waiting in line, because the Chipotle always had a line going, I was watching the line work. And I was watching the way, like, everything was laid out, but there was still this, like, there was an interaction, even if it wasn't the way, like, I realized that what we were doing, where I would slice the meat, and Alex, who was next to me, or Jamie, who ended up working for me, his name as well, would put the pickles and the sauce on. And then, you know, my wife or my, you know, my friend Rebecca, who also worked for us, would then do the money, or Rebecca would work. It was interchangeable. There was three of us. And it was like this efficiency of like meat topping money. Gotcha. And it dawned on me that all the barbecue travels I'd had with my father, it was either sit down where you didn't see the smoker and it was coming from the back, or you might see a smoker or some kind of hint of it or smell it if you were in Texas. But it was cafeteria style, but it was all like on these steam wells, mm-hmm. where nothing was being cut, and it was all under heat lamps, and it all looked really sad. And it just dawned on me that like the cutting of the meat, like there's this visceral thing,
without a doubt,
that people were reacting to when I was slicing the brisket in front of them, that if we were to take that component and plug it into a Chipotle style line, we would be the first barbecue technically like doing this QSR thing, mm-hmm. but like really smoking the meat, like not hard boiling, not, you know, cooking in ovens, you know, it was like real barbecue. And so that was kind of the genesis, that was the beginning, the inkling of a seed of genesis to get into the idea. And then where Misha came into play big with that was that when that inkling of an idea started, he was able to take that. And really, he's a number guy. He was working in hedge funds. So he was able to take that and then start working real numbers and metrics and say, like, this is what we can do. And this is the numbers we can do. And this is like how many people we can serve. Like, it was all like, that was the matrix shit that I have no mind for. I'm like, I can tell you what tastes good, what looks good. And like, you know, what music sounds good. But beyond that, like I'm an idea guy, but they jokingly call me the poet. Like I'm like the art guy, and those guys know much more about business. So then, you know, it seemed like a good kind of triangle because Misha was very money oriented and very smart with that. And I was not, and I was a passion guy about the food and the vibe and the music and the look. And Chris was so great with operations. He had been through build outs. He had been through restaurants. He had come up in restaurants.
That was so helpful. That was so helpful.
It was a perfect kind of triangle that we all were good at certain things and respected each other. So yeah, then we started looking for spaces and we found one space we really wanted that was actually in Brooklyn. And we just had a hard time negotiating the space. It was like this old like car garage, like auto body shop. And it was, it would have been thing that ever happened to us for it to not have come to fruition because everyone was gravitating towards Brooklyn. Because there was kind of this influx of barbecue that has, there was one at that time called Fat Sow, but before, after Fat Sow, there was nobody else at that moment except for them. And so then after we opened, and the time we opened, other barbecue places started opening up in Brooklyn. We ended up on East 6th Street, which was one block from where my original apartment was. East Village was the only place I'd ever lived. There was perfect. Like this, Chris found something in his coat pocket from a coat check with this guy's name on it. Totally weird. And it was like the owner of this building that the restaurant that was there had just gone out of business and they were looking for a tenant. It hadn't even hit the market yet. Wow. And that was, the restaurant was called Van Dag, but it had previously been like six other restaurants in 10 years. Failed, all of them failed.
Which is scary. One
was, it was actually a barbecue place as well. So it had like the New York kiss of death. And then we went and looked at the place and we were like, I literally the words that I said was jump on that shit. Like it was that, it was like, this is the one, this is it. And we got it. And I think that's one of the things that separated us from everybody else is we opened in Manhattan. And we had a smoker in the dining room. So like I was sleeping in the restaurant, you know, I was only going home on Sunday afternoons. So I would spend 6 days at the restaurant. I'd sleep in the office and the smoker was 24 hours a day. I would feed wood to it. There was no assist on it.
What type of smoker was it?
J&R Oiler. Okay. But it's the non-E. So literally there's no electric assist. Mm-hmm. So at that point I was such a control freak that I was like, I slept in the restaurant. I controlled the fire. I touched every piece of meat, every cut that went down the line. I had my hands on it, you know, along with Alex. And then, you know, we had a couple of really good core guys that came on. But like that was the genesis of the first Mighty Quinn's.
And what was the menu at that time?
The menu when we first opened was everything we have now with the exception of a couple of sides that were different. Like we had an edamame salad that was seasonal, like the things that we've just switched out rotated seasonally, but a couple of things that were not on the menu, we didn't have anything fried. Because when we got the restaurant, we were still waiting for permitting to run a second flue for the smoker.
Okay.
But we can't open a barbecue place without a smoker. So we literally diverted into the other flue, which is what the hood was for the fryers.
Oh, interesting.
So, but you can't combine creosote with fryer oil.
No.
You know, vapors. Very dangerous. So we couldn't do anything fried. And then eventually when we got the second flue, the second exhaust put in, that was, you know, dedicated for the fryers. Then we put the wings, like all that stuff was done. We just couldn't do it until we had.
Well, and it's New York is very difficult.
Yeah.
For that.
Yeah. So that's.
And that what was the reaction in the neighborhood? What were people saying?
I mean, there was like a couple people that hated us in the building that had been like, you know, they were, you know, rent controlled in the building and they were like, it smells like barbecue. Da, da, da.
Oh, that.
Yeah. But I mean, like the place that was there before us and the place before that were open till 2 a.m. They were like full bars, like, you know, crazy. And, you know, we were closing at 11 o'clock. Actually, we stayed open till like 1 a.m. I think the first weekend. And then when we realized like that we actually had to be there, like waiting on these people that were like going to throw up because they were so drunk. Like that was the clientele after 11,
yeah,
you know, we were like, okay, this is just stupid, yeah. You know? So we nixed that quickly, but we are beer only. So, you know, we tried to become more of a neighborhood place was our goal. And I think we succeeded in that with the exception of like a couple of rent control people who just, you know, were curmudgeons just for the sake of being curmudgeons. And they would have been pissed no matter what went in the building.
And were you selling out at the time?
No, we were not. I mean, we were doing fine, but the smoker's capacity nightly on that smoker with hot spots, I could do 48 briskets. And at that point, we were not selling 48 briskets a day. We were selling a lot of food, but no. This was December 12th, or December 19th, 2012 is when we opened. So, I mean, we were busy, but by no stretch were we like selling out. We were comfortably selling food, but not to the point where we were selling out. Where the mayhem ensued was March 6th of 13, okay. Was the night that the Pete Wells review happened. And from that point on, it was fucking mayhem. We got to the point where 48 briskets on the Oiler, and then the smoker I just showed you, we had set up in the parking lot of the Venetian in New Jersey. So I would run to New Jersey and smoke on that smoker too. So we were doing 15 briskets there and 48, and that still wasn't enough. We were selling out of
beef ribs too at that time?
Yeah, we were doing everything. I mean, and we were maxing the smoker out. Like, the smoker was literally to the gills. We had to order second set of shelves because we couldn't clean them fast enough. So we would just take the dirty shelves out and put the clean ones in, you know, and then work rotations. It was like I would clean the smoker where I take the shelves out and jump in and like do a scrub down while it was still hot. Gotcha. Because we just didn't have time to shut it down. We were selling out the first like week. We couldn't play catch up fast enough because obviously with barbecue, you have to work kind of 2 days ahead, not in the smoke, but like, you know, I'm seasoning today for what I'm going to mm-hmm. smoke tomorrow. Yeah. And what I'm smoking tomorrow won't be ready until the day after that because it goes overnight. So the first like 3-4 days of that New York Times review, we were literally having to close the doors at 7 p.m. And that works if you're, you know, on the road in Austin, Texas with, you know, $1,000 a month in rent, you know, or whatever, yeah. You know, but at the rents we pay in New York, like it's not viable to close early, mm-hmm. You know, you just have to increase what you, your volume. And so at that point we were going through, I got 63 briskets a day. Wow. We were selling.
That's crazy. And,
yeah, I think the largest amount of people we served in a day was like 1,600 people out of the East Village. And that was with 55 seats, to give you a perspective.
That's amazing. So a lot of to-go business too.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was nuts, but it was like the greatest. It was the greatest mayhem ever, and it was like a bubble. I was in like it was the Mighty Quinn's bubble because I like anything outside the restaurant, with the exception of like talking to my wife and kids, like nothing else. Like nothing was on my radar. Like I wouldn't even leave the restaurant to go get food. Like I would send people to go grab me like, you know, a falafel from Mamoon's or whatever because I was like I couldn't even leave. You know?
That's insane. So when did you guys open up additional locations?
Second location was our Clifton, New Jersey location. We opened that location up in March of 2014. Yeah, March of 14.
Okay.
So once we opened that location, we figured some things out at that location in terms of like sending food to... that we could send food to another location if we needed to, because we had two smokers working there. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of that was that we opened up the next location after that was Brookfield Place. And the reason we needed Clifton to open up Brookfield was because Brookfield, you can't smoke in. Okay. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to Brookfield, but it's like the most high end food court you've ever been to. I mean, it's the most amazing model because it's in the financial district. American Express has their offices next door. So when they go to lunch, you have 1,000 people. Basically, like every day from 11:30 to 2:30, it's like that 3-hour or 2-hour window is like the busiest dinner at any other restaurant.
Wow.
There's like 8 restaurants that are there, and none of it is like fast food. All of us are like, you know, high end fast casual and or just like, you know, doing really great stuff. Like you've got Blue Ribbon Sushi, Fuku, my gosh, Dig In, Dos Toros, Chopped, you know, and then us. So it's like, it's all localized New York vendors in there. But we needed a smoker offsite for that location.
Gotcha.
So Clifton proved to be the offsite smoker for that location.
Wow. So what's the progression from?
It basically, you know, honestly, it was kind of, we opened Clifton, then Battery Park, and then the locations were easier to open because once we realized we could do it, you know, we were just opening a few more locations. And then, you know, honestly, you know, we've got 5 in New York now. The international market was kind of the next step, mm-hmm. where we partnered with the franchisees. The first ones were in Taiwan. And that kind of taught us that franchisees who cared could do well with it, because we, you know, like we would, they would come here and we would train them and then we would go there. Most of the like all the international franchises, like to open, I would go there for 2 to 3 weeks along with, you know, either John Logsdon, who's our director of ops, who also is an accomplished chef, or Alex, and then Chris and Misha would also come over. So we would get all the teams open properly and then we do checks. So I'm supposed to actually fly to Dubai in 4 weeks to go there for, there's like a thing called Gulf Food, which is like this food show competition thing. And there's like a barbecue piece to that. So they want me to be there for that. Currently I'm figuring out what days I got to go, cause I have a potential thing with Food Network that week right before it. So like, it's just kind of mayhem. So
you have, Philippines, Dubai, and,
Philippines, and Dubai and Taiwan. Yeah. Wow.
That's really exciting. So you have 9 locations in the US or is it?
No. Well, yeah, let's see. 5 in the city, 2 in Jersey, 1 in Westchester, Yankee Stadium. And then the first franchisee just signed on for Long Island.
Long Island, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
There'll be 2 locations for that, right?
I think the goal will be more than 2, but I'm like, you know, knock on wood. Let's get the first one right, and then we'll go from there, you know?
Oh, crazy. That's like, you thinking possibly to, like, even L.A.?
I mean, you know, if the right opportunity presents itself, I think we're open-minded to anything. I mean, we're currently in talks for potentially opening Australia, which would be awesome. We seem to have, like, you know, with Taiwan and Manila, we chose places that were going through some political issues at the time, which is, our timing was funny with that. But, I mean, it's all good. And, I mean, like, again, I'm happy to be here. You know, like, this, for me, it's like, at this point, it's all gravy.
A lot of gravy,
it's
just like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I'm not talking monetary gravy yet, but the gravy of just like, this thing started in the driveway, mm-hmm. and like, you know, look at where it's gone. It's
like you said, you had $600 to your name, and now look at this, you have.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I mean, you know, Chris, Misha, myself, we've obviously all put our heart and soul into this thing, and it's great to see that it's, you know, starting to kind of branch out. And you know, there's like this really cool feeling of like, you know, we have like 300 employees, you know, globally or more that are, you know, that, you know, I was like begging for work essentially, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, here we are, like we're able to give people a chance. And, you know, hopefully like what I've noticed is, like you said, there's a huge takeaway to like showing people that like you can fail mm-hmm. miserably and still, you know, that can be a huge, it can end up being a win if you choose to harness it properly. You know, I like to say I failed forward, you know?
Yeah. That's great. And then like, I want to wrap it up with what's up with the bike cycling. You cycle a lot, right?
A lot. I mean, that goes back to like those dark days. I kind of got into riding at that point. I mean, riding is something that like riding a bike is the first moment that all of us, you, me, my kids, anybody has an ounce of freedom. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you think about like the first time you got on a bike without training wheels and you turn the corner, like where your parents can't see you anymore, like there's that rush of like, holy shit, I'm on my own, mm-hmm. like freedom. You know what I mean? So as a kid, that was like my freedom, like riding bikes and skateboarding. But then when I was an adult and we were going through a complete financial fucking destruction, the only time that I felt like nothing but the moment was when I was like on my bike going up a hill. It hurt, but it hurt so good because I wasn't thinking about being behind on my mortgage. I wasn't thinking about the bills I couldn't pay. I wasn't thinking about like, what the fuck am I going to do next? I was just thinking about get up the fucking hill. You know what I mean? Like, so like there's this beautiful connection to mm-hmm. it. So for me, there's that piece. And then, so that was the first leg of it where it represents kind of clarity and peace and presence for mm-hmm. me. So I had done it just for that and loved it. And we opened the first location, like I said, December of 2012. And for that first 6 to 8 months, like my bike just stayed in a corner. Because I was working my ass off and, you know, doing what I had to do. And I don't regret any of that. Yeah. But I was drinking probably like the equivalent of 6, you know, beers a day. And because I was just trying to get myself to go to take 30-minute naps, you know, like however I could, as fast as I could. So I'd like shoot a Founders Porter, you know, at 2 a.m. and nap for 30 minutes and then shoot another one. And I was up to 178 pounds, which I'm 5'9", and like for my frame, that's a little big. And I just didn't feel healthy. And I had a moment on New Year's Eve, the following New Year's Eve, after the first year we were open, where I had kind of a heart scare that ended up not being as bad as what it sounds like. It was just an abnormal EKG on a physical, and it's a long story, but I ended up rushing to the ER with my family there. And my wife's stepfather, who is on the board of the hospital, came and saw me there and like said, "Your lungs are in great shape. Your heart, it just seems..." Basically, it was like I was like kind of having a constant, like I had like an arrhythmia, but I was in like a constant state of like a panic attack.
Okay.
Without even knowing it. It was just the way I was operating. And he basically said, like, you need to exercise, you know, like you need to get back to doing something that gets your body moving again. And so I started riding at that point just to like do it again, you know. And 2.5 years ago, my agent, who is also my friend, Scott Feldman's his name, he and his like right hand, Sarah Jane Coulihan, we were sitting down for a meeting to kind of go over like the stuff that I had, you know, coming up on the agenda for like TV or anything potential. And they've been like with me since my first show was back in 2008. I was Michael and Simon's sous chef on a TV show called Cook Like an Iron Chef. And
mm-hmm. I love that show, but I don't think a lot of people know about that show. That was
awesome. Yeah, it was on Cooking Channel.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And it was a cool set.
The set was awesome. We were the last show ever filmed on in Horvath Studios, which is on West 12th Street. After that show was done, they tore the building down and repurposed it.
Oh, okay.
But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Michael is like one of my close friends, and he's been a mentor. And so Scott is his agent, and he connected me with Scott. And I was lucky enough that Scott, Scott doesn't take people on unless he sees something. And like, I don't know what he saw, but he took me on. And so they've been support for me for a long time, and even when I wasn't doing shit. And this Sarah Jane and Scott knew of this chef named Chef Jason Roberts, who is now a good friend of mine, who started a ride called Chef Cycle.
Okay.
And Chef Cycle is an arm, or they raise money for No Kid Hungry, which No Kid Hungry and Share Our Strength are what all like the New York City Food and Wine, like it all goes to Share Our Strength. And they said, they do a yearly ride and you should, you know, take a look at it. And this is Jason's brainchild, and you know, he's an awesome dude from Australia. And so I looked into it and signed on for a ride that was like 3 months later, and I had to raise money for it. And I started just like, you know, making sure I was riding more, and I went and did it. And it was like, it wasn't just awesome. It was like utopia, because it was 300 chefs hanging out, or 250 chefs hanging out in Santa Rosa, California. And
already that sounds awesome.
Yeah, and we were all riding bikes, and it was the coolest part that, like, not everyone talks about, but, like, most of the time when we all get together, when any of us chefs, like, we hang in a large group, it's, like, things like New York City Food and Wine or South Beach, which are amazing, and, like, they're so much fun to do, but you're always kind of, like, looking over your shoulder, checking out what your buddy did, and it's, like, there's an air of competition, even without it being a competition, you know, because mm-hmm. You're measuring yourself against other people. And but at Chef Cycle in Santa Rosa, like, none of us are cooking there. We're just like together and hanging out. It's like summer camp, you know? And, you know, some of us, like, there's like a handful of us who are like guys who race and who take it pretty seriously. Myself, you know, Jason, Jeff Mann, you know, Seamus Mullen. And like, these are guys who, through Chef Cycle, like, we all became friends, and, you know, like, Travis Strickland and Brian Dunsmore, like all these dudes, Travis Flood, like Lentine Alexis, we've all become like family. And they're like in literally within a matter of 4 days, like on that trip, I made lifelong friends.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's because we share something outside of what we do, you know? And like, I, you know, Jeff is a prime example. Like, you know, Jeff had a rough year last year in terms of, I mean, he's had a great year, but he his father passed away. And, like, you know, like, I felt for him because, like, even though we only hung for 3 days, like, Jeff has become someone who I care deeply about, you know, and Jason, you know, who lives in Australia, you know, like, he'll see if I, like, he'll hear or I'll post something that maybe looks like I'm not as happy that day, and he'll call to check on me, and, like, that's invaluable. Like,
that's huge. That's amazing. That's huge, yeah.
And it's infectious. And, you know, the thing with riding for me is I've become far healthier since being a part of Chef Cycle, and, you know, I've lost, like, 40 pounds from that 178, and I eat better now. Doesn't mean I don't eat barbecue. I just pay more attention to what I do because I've got 3 kids that I want them to see a healthy lifestyle as an example. And then I've been really fortunate, like, that I ride. I can kind of ride fast, and, you know, like, I've been lucky, and I have, you know, some, like, brand ambassadorships with that now, and
that's really cool. Yeah, I've noticed photos on Instagram of you cycling.
I'm over it, because I know that, like, not everyone, like, is into that. They're like, show me some food. But, but the cycling is, like, we all, I think Malcolm Gladwell, the writer, said it best, where he was like, he thinks that anyone who doesn't have an obsession outside of their work is off. Like, there's some, like, everyone needs something that they daydream about doing outside of their work.
That's important.
Like, you know, like, whether it's running or tennis or golf or cycling. Or, like, people that, you know, are work in offices and dream about, you know, firing up the smoker and took a barbecue. You know, it's like we all need that, like, outside passion.
No, it's important. If you don't have it, it's almost hard to exist. It's hard to go forward.
Yeah, and my wife is similar. She runs. Laura runs, and so I, you know, between, like, the two of us, like, our kids have an example of two parents who, like, don't like to sit down.
Yeah, that's important.
Always on the go, and I think that, like, for them, it's, like, a good example of, like, you know, just get up and go.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Hugh, thank you. Like, we could talk for another hour, and
if you want more info, or, you know, you want to chat more, just let me know.
Thanks so much, and have a great rest of your week. And I
appreciate the time.